We have come this evening to verse 19 and 20, but particularly verse 19, where he talks about the anxious longing of the creation waiting eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God, and then explaining, and we'll be talking more about that next week, but the creation was subjected to futility, not voluntarily, but because of him who subjected it. In our last look in this text, we were looking at verse 18, where Paul declared that there's no actual basis for comparison between the level of sufferings that dominate the present time and the divine commitment to bring about a level of glory in the future that will more than adequately address the reality of his character in a way that can't be done in time. I've thought a little bit about that, and I really think that if you seriously believe in the infinity of God, which is a concept that most of us really can't get wrapped around, infinity is one of those things that's beyond us. But anyway, it makes sense to me that if God is infinite, any time-bound creature is going to be shocked by what's available once we get out of this locked-in time frame thing. And I really don't know how much of that's going to be actually gone, because the scriptures present ongoing events, sequential ongoing events, and that's what we define as time. So I don't know how the future is going to be. But Paul, having been there, saw some things he couldn't even tell us about. He said it was forbidden to speak of them. But nonetheless, he came away with this understanding that it doesn't really matter in time what happens in terms of whatever we have to be subject to be faithful to the truth. God's going to make it way, way, way more worth our while, if we can say it that way. So there's really no comparison. And he made this declaration on the basis of verse 18's statement, "I consider," because that word means that he's adopted it as a fundamental part of his way of looking at reality. And he tried to make it as clear as he could to the people of God that we need to put this perspective into a dominant place in our own understanding and faith. Because one of the major flaws of humanity is our profound tendency to blow the tiny into the huge when it's negative, and perhaps even when it's positive, depending on how you view negative and positive. But, you know, a person who never has any serious issues, if they get a hangnail, it's a major deal. But a person who gets a hangnail who's been through a prisoner of war camp or something like that, they don't probably even know they've got a hangnail, because it's such a minor issue. And yet, because we are so focused on our own experience and our own selves, everything's supposed to turn around us, we tend to blow the tiny into the huge. And then we let that tiny dominate our perspective so that it eats away at our experience of the life that God wants us to enjoy. So Paul's answer to this flaw is to declare a no comparison barrier between our present experience, no matter how bad it is, because it's an experience of corruption, and our future experience of an absolutely corruption-free glory that is surely coming. And the reason why I said earlier that the glory of the future will more than adequately address the reality of God's character is because this is where his whole plan's coming from, is his own character. And his commitment to provide us with life is a commitment to share, in my understanding, it's his commitment to share something about all of the major attributes that make him God. He doesn't share any of the attributes' total essence, because that's infinite and he can't. But to the degree that we're ignorant of something that's true about God, to that degree our life is limited. And I really believe that Paul teaches, particularly in the next chapter, that God has a willingness to put up with stuff simply because of the good that he can bring out of it that wouldn't be able to come out any other way. For example, he says God is willing to put up with the corruption of the wicked in order to make his power and wrath known. Well, you can demonstrate power in a lot of ways, but wrath can only legitimately be expressed against an object that's worthy of it or deserves it. And unless there's some that deserve it, you'll never see it. And if you never see it, then that's a part of his character that you'll never know about, which means that your life will be somewhat less than it could be. So, when we deal with this issue of the experience of corruption that we're surrounded with, there's no escape from it. Even our best moments have their painful elements. They may be very minor, but even our best moments are not perfect. And we're going to be translated out of that into perfection. So the whole issue here is that Paul wants us to recognize that whatever we're subjected to here is not worthy to be compared to the glory that's to follow. And a big part of this issue is the fact that the promised glory is assuredly coming. It doesn't matter if people say, oh, where's the promise of his coming? Everything's going on like it has from the creation of the world. Da, 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 da. Unbelief and scoffing and arguments to the contrary to the truth have been around ever since Genesis 3. They're always going to be around until we're delivered from this corruption. But they don't mean that we can't believe what God has said is true. So, this evening what we're going to do is to at least begin to look at Paul's attempt to create a solid basis for faith in this inevitability, because verse 19, like verse 18, starts off with 4. Verse 18 came off of verse 17, where we're going to be fellow heirs of the Christ if we suffer with him, so that we can be glorified together with him, because verse 18 has this issue of suffering and glorification. But then in verse 19, he's giving another reason, but it's a reason that has to do with the glory that's to be revealed to us and the anticipation of that glory. And that's the thing that he wants us to get in our heads, that we're to anticipate this. It's supposed to be a major part of our conscious awareness through our living, to let that issue be a fundamental reality that we are aware of, consciously aware of, a good bit of the time. So he blows up the magnitude of the anticipation issue in verse 19 by saying, in the New American Standard, the anxious longing, the idea that the creation, the King James says the creature, but they are not consistent in their translation of that issue. Verse 21 is the consistent issue of the creation itself will be set free. So I think verse 19, there's an anxious longing of the creation too. But the whole issue here is this anticipating thing. And his first concept in verse 19 is this issue of a forward-looking, distance-accepting mindset. In other words, it's a future expectation that we know is distant from us from the immediate present till whenever the future does come, and we accept that. In fact, he even says a little bit later on, verse 24, in hope we've been saved, but hope that's seen is not hope, for why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we eagerly wait for it. Well, that's the idea of accepting the distance in time. It's a temporal distance, not a spatial one. The promise that Jesus is coming back has been a part of Christian truth from the time he first told them. John 14, if I go away, I'll come again, receive you to myself. All of these ideas that instead of there being, like the Jews thought, two messiahs, and perhaps one coming. New Testament theology has one Messiah with two comings. And the fact that the second coming has been preached for 2,000 and some years has led a lot of people into this mindset that, it's not going to happen. 2,000 years have gone by. Just keep in mind that Genesis 3:15 was 4,000 years before Jesus came. So the promise of his first coming, You had to wait a long time for that. So it's a distance accepting thing. But it's a mindset. Forward looking, distance accepting. You look, anticipate it, recognize there's going to be an interim and accept that, and then have that as your mindset. The King James calls it earnest expectation. The NASB calls it anxious longing. And the question is, how do you get there from here? What's the difference between an earnest expectation and an anxious longing in your English vocabulary? Anxious is almost a negative term. Not always. kids are anxious for Christmas to come. That's not negative. But anxiety is usually one of those things that you're not supposed to be anxious for. You're not supposed to be anxious for anything. So it's kind of a negative. And yet the earnest expectation thing is not a very good translation in consideration with the only other time Paul used the word in Philippians 1:20. Because there, he's looking forward to being pulled up before Caesar and being subjected to the temptation of not being faithful to his calling. And he's asking the Philippians to pray for him that according to his, quote, earnest expectation and hope, he won't cave in under the pressure of that kind of intimidation. That's not what you call a real positive expectation. I'm going to be dragged into this mess, and then I'm going to have to be faithful. And I don't know if I can be faithful, so I'm going to ask these people to pray that the Spirit of God will give me the courage to be faithful. And that's a negative scenario, and yet this word is used. What does he really mean, the earnest expectation or the anxious longing of the creation? Liddell Scott Dictionary claims that this term, the word, is translated this way, is only used by Christians. They could never find it outside of the Christian community. And even the Christian community, the records of people using are very small. So there's just a little bit of information about the word. So when you find that to be the case, I am automatically then work backwards into the etymology to see if there's any connection between the meaning the word had when it was first coined and the context. There is what they call an etymological fallacy, where just because a word was coined to mean something, you can't assume that that's the meaning all the way through the rest of its uses, because words change and flex and morph into something else. Just like, well, we have all kinds of phrases in English that meant one thing when I was a kid, and they mean something else differently now. And some of the things that were basically harmless expressions when I was a kid are now fairly suggestive type negative things. And so you have to be careful what you say, depending on which generation you're talking to. But the reality is that sometimes words hold their meaning. This word was actually formed by three different Greek words. One of them was a preposition that meant away from, which is your distance issue. And the other one had to do with your head. And the other one had to do with the way something appeared to be. It seemed to be like this. So you put those things together and you say, well, the head is thinking about something a little bit further away and how it appears to be possibly developing. In other words, it's a scenario building kind of thing in your mind where you anticipate that something's going to happen, and then you anticipate what your reaction or response might be when that happens. And that's exactly what Paul is talking about here. He has already given us the anticipation. We're going to be brought into a kind of glory that cannot be compared to any of the suffering that we've been subjected to in order to be faithful people. There's just no comparison. It was like that illustration I used two weeks ago, where you can't buy a car for a dime that costs 8 point whatever million or whatever. I don't even remember the numbers now. But it's just an incredibly huge difference, so that you can't really compare them. Well, that's the anticipation that Paul wants us to have, that there is this enormously significant future that God has laid out there. But he also recognizes that in our heads, we not only need to have that anticipation, but we need to have it from a distance, so that we accept the fact that there's a distance. And so the etymology actually seems to fit both Philippians 1:20, where the word is used by Paul, and the only other New Testament text where it's used. Because in both of these cases, there's an anticipation of something. It's not necessarily positive, but it's an anticipation. In this text, it's the anticipation of enormous glory to come. And in Philippians 1:20, it's the anticipation of being dragged before Caesar to be tried to see if you're going to live or die. So it's an anticipation. It's not necessarily a positive one. But nonetheless, with that in mind, then you have to use your head to think about, what the significance of that is right now in my situation. And that's what Paul is dealing with here and in Philippians. How am I supposed to handle today in light of? And when you stop and think about it, if it's really true that there is this incomparable glory going to come off of any choice that we make and act on that has to do with some kind of sacrifice on our part, because that's what suffering is, this some kind of sacrifice on our part, if that's really true, then if we have that anticipation in our minds and it's a focus of our attention and we've accepted the fact that dessert is last and we're thinking about how we're going to act now, well, how are we going to act if we realize that if we're being called on to make some kind of sacrifice, if it includes any kind of suffering whatsoever, body, soul, or spirit, if it's going to bring an incomparable glory for making the choice to be faithful, if we really believe that, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to be faithful. We're going to depend on God to do what He's going to do and to give us the grace to handle whatever comes. And don't go to that nonsense I hear all the time. Whenever somebody gets into a suffering situation, they say, well, God's big enough to handle that. That's not the point. Sure, He's big enough to handle it. The question is not whether He's big enough to handle it. The question is whether He's going to handle it in such a way that He delivers you from the suffering. And the answer to that is not a lot of the time. A lot of the time, He does not take you out of a situation, and you're there. And you have to make the same choice of sacrifice day after day after day, because that's where you are. And you can ask God to deliver you, but He may say, like He did to Paul, nope, it's for your best interest for you to be there. And so the answer is no, at least for now. But that no answer is not a problem if we really have this future perspective, accepting the distance between the present sacrifice and the ultimate glory. So I really think that the etymology has maintained, Paul may have actually coined this word since it's only found in Christian literature and he only uses it twice in the New Testament. If he coined it, then the issue is he meant to give these people an impression that's very, very critically necessary if we're going to walk with God in the light, to have the right orientation concerning the present suffering. And that orientation is endure it. It's going to be worth it. Enormously so. So, you have this distance in time between the present and the future. You have this mental energy spent considering the expected eventuality, and you have the issue of appearance that seems to be, how is that scenario going to work out and what am I going to do in the face of it? So, that's the basic idea of the word, and how you translate that is kind of an interesting question, because the translators attempt to indicate the priority that's placed on the future event and how things are going to be played out, because both sets of translators, AV and NASB, put in earnest or anxious. Earnest or anxious. And then they put in expectation or longing. So the real issue here is, what is the scenario? In Romans 8, the scenario is this incomparable glory. Well, then, you're not anxious about it, except in the sense of, boy, I wish it'd come really quickly. The idea of longing is probably a better idea. There's this longing for this reality to be. So maybe we could take what the translators did and turn it in, instead of being earnest expectation and anxious longing, maybe we could call it a longing expectation. expectation is so much a part of our thinking that we just long for the coming of it. That's the first thing he wanted us to do, is to get into this idea of a forward-looking, distance-accepting mindset. The context argues that the future event is taking up a lot of the person's attention. so that he's focusing on what the future is going to look like based on what's going on right now. And Paul's already made the basic declaration. The future is going to look like incomparable glory compared to the suffering of the present. And that raises the question of the issue of how much emotional energy is involved, where the translators try to say earnest or anxious. The text both indicate a hope-filled perspective that puts the present in its place as a tiny thing, so that we don't blow it up into a big thing. The big thing is the incomparable glory. The little thing is the suffering. And there's no comparison. So the suffering is never going to be a big thing. It's always going to be a tiny thing. No matter how painful it gets, it's not easy to view it as a tiny thing, but it really is. So Paul is really just dealing, the first thing he's dealing with is this forward-looking, temporal distance accepting mindset, where we look forward to the eternal glory, recognize that it probably isn't going to be today, may not be tomorrow, but it is coming, and we just accept that mindset. The second thing that he does in his anticipation, he really wants to get the Romans fixated on this. The second thing he does is he turns the creation into a person. It's called an anthropomorphism, because he talks about this longing expectation of the creation and an eager waiting. So whenever you take an inanimate thing like the creation and you turn it into a thinking, reasoning being, an anthropomorphic idea, the whole idea there is that they're trying to make, he's trying to make it seem like every bug, every plant, every tree, every flower is eagerly waiting. All the parts of creation are eagerly waiting. The stars are singing their songs, eagerly waiting. And yet we all know, or at least we think we do, that insensate creation issues don't have emotions and they don't anticipate and they don't think and all of that kind of thing. Wouldn't it be something if C.S. Lewis was right and the trees actually were a sensible creation? But nonetheless, we don't see them that way. We don't mind cutting a tree down because we're not hurting it. It isn't crying about its loss of life, whatever. But the point is, he turns this entire creation into a sensible, thinking, feeling being, and he claims that the entire creation has this forward-looking, distance-accepting mindset. And yet, by the very fact that he's emphasizing this to the Romans to get them to adopt that mindset, he is tacitly admitting that at least parts of the creation don't have it. The whole creation as a whole is looking eagerly for this, but apparently it's the insensible creation that's eagerly waiting this, because the sensible part, the, and I use that word in a specialized way, the ones that can think and feel and see, not sensible in the sense of being reasonable or rational, the sensate creatures are not looking forward to that. And he wants the Romans to divorce themselves from that blindness and say, look, your destiny is enormously glorious and it's built off of the sufferings that you are subjected to now. So buy into it. That's the way it's going to be. So by bringing the creation into it and turning it into a thinking, feeling thing, he is simply exploding this notion that the future is something that even a dumb tree knows is going to be better than whatever it has to suffer now. So you can be dumb as a post, and it's not a problem. So, the third thing that he does in the verse is he deals with this, what the King or the New American Standard translates, eager waiting. Waits eagerly. He wrote that this whole creation has this forward-looking mindset that's settled into its acceptance of distance in time, and so it's waiting. And that's what he actually reinforces, because in verse 24 and 25, he uses the same terminology. He says in verse 25, if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly. That's the same word. We wait for it. We have this hope. We can't see it, but we know what it is, basically. And we are waiting patiently with perseverance, waiting eagerly for what is to come. And so, in a very real sense, particularly verse 25 of this chapter, uses this word for eager waiting by telling us pointedly, the reason that you have to wait is because there is this temporal distance. The promise was made, but the fulfillment's not going to be for a while. And as we said at the beginning, the promise in Genesis 3:15 took 4,000 years to be realized in human history. And there were countless generations of human beings who lived and died and never saw the coming of the Christ. And then the generation that did see it were so blinded by their antipathy for the truth that they wouldn't even accept him when he was here. So the issue is, there's something crucial about being willing to be waiting. Don't let it destroy your confidence that the future is going to be as described. Just realize that there's a period in which you have to wait. And I think probably every generation has had its tendency to be, I want it now. Because that's what created microwaves. Microwave ovens didn't develop because people were willing to wait for a regular oven to bake whatever or cook whatever. Somebody had to want it more immediately in order to even think of a different way of cooking so that you could turn 30 minutes into 3. So I think humanity as a whole just has this tendency to say, I want it and I want it now. Well, now is not realistic. So then the question then is, you have to be willing to wait, and you have to have a sort of or a kind of emotional stability that exists because of the strength of the conviction that the scenario to come is going to come, just like expected. In other words, this future thing, this incomparable glory, you can't afford to let it be diminished by whatever arguments that the adversary will throw at you. And I'll tell you one of the first ones he'll throw at you is, you're not suffering for Jesus in this case. You're just suffering, so you're not going to get any glory out of this. Or he'll diminish or demean whatever it is that you're involved in and turn it into, well, that doesn't qualify. You're not going to get any glory out of that. But the fact is, every day that we live, if we are depending on God by His Spirit to guide us into our day and into the things, in every day that we live, we are actually dying to our own agenda. So Paul said, I die daily. The whole idea is Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you have to deny yourself and take up my cross and follow me. So this self-denial, whatever you're dealing with because of the issues that you're facing, all of it's tied to the possibility of eternal glory, enormous glory. And that's what the judgment seat of Christ actually tells us. That our whole life is mixed up in wood, hay, and stubble, and gold, silver, and precious stones. And the gold, silver, and precious stones arise out of the mindset that says, I'm going to do this thing that's right and faithful and good now, even if it costs me seriously now, because the serious cost is a tiny thing relating to the future. So, in spite of all the arguments of the adversary, Paul wants us to have this clear-eyed view of the glory that's to come and be willing to wait on it and maintain, by his Spirit, this emotional stability that allows us to keep on saying, I know the pain is severe, but it's a tiny thing. Because that's really the truth. It doesn't sound true, and it doesn't even sound very sympathetic. So you might not want to say it to somebody else, but you need to say it to yourself. Whatever God is asking me to endure now is a tiny thing compared to the glory that's to come. And that gives us the emotional stability to be consistently faithful day after day. So then the question arises, where did the creation get this idea How is it eagerly waiting? Where did the creation come to grips with the fact that there was this scenario of enormous glory? Well, I think from two, we get two answers to that, at least two. In the first place, Enoch, who is quoted by Jude in our New Testament, prophesied the second coming of the Christ, because he said, I see 10,000 of the holy ones coming with the Lord. The Lord is coming with 10,000 of his holy ones. That wasn't the flood. Enoch was the seventh from Adam. He was pre-flood, but his prophecy was exactly the same terminology of our understanding of the second coming. So Enoch knew that there was going to be this coming of the Lord with all of these holy ones to establish the kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. He was the seventh from Adam, Jude says. So early on, the prophets knew. Not only that, but if we can trust Josephus as a historian, and I don't know where he got his information, but he said that Seth was the originator of the symbolism of the zodiac that traces the theology of the Christ from his coming as the virgin's offspring in Virgo and goes through all of the theology of Messiah and comes back to the line of the tribe of Judah. And so if he's the author of the symbolism that starts with the first coming and ends with the second coming, then you've got to know that God had already planted that firmly in the minds of the first generations of humanity, if not all of creation. But secondly, as an extra biblical argument, the infinity of God and all of the attributes that are attributed to a deity in any kind of legitimate sense, which goodness would be one of them, infinite goodness automatically assumes this phenomenal, glorious outcome. It just does. Just on a rational basis, if God is infinite in all of his attributes, and that includes power and goodness and all the rest, then there's going to have to be a final, glorious, good, enormous, powerfully supported outcome. So the creation is not, I mean, even a dumb stone might be smarter than the smartest human being if it comes to this issue of realizing that God's going to have this outcome. He's already said it. He's declared it. The creation knows about it. And is eagerly awaiting it. So, somehow, this early revelation about God settled into the very narrow scope of creation into human beings so that there was, in the prophets and the people of God, even when the people of God was narrowed down to Noah and however many of his family believed, however many, there were only eight altogether, and we don't know whether they were believers or not. Noah was, and the family was saved because of his confidence, but whether they were believers or not, the prophets and the people of God, no matter how few there were, have had this long, forward-looking, distance-accepting expectation that God's going to bring about this really huge thing so that the sufferings of the present time, the tiny things, would be put properly in their place. And then the last part of the verse tells us what it's eagerly waiting for. It's the revelation of the sons of the God. Now, in verse 18, the glory is that which is to be revealed. But in verse 19, the revelation is of the sons of the God. And so there is an issue here of changing from the revelation of the glory to the revelation of the sons who are going to participate in that glory. How is this going to affect the sons of God, the sons of the God? So Paul is identifying this huge thing. The creation is eagerly longing to see what the sons of God are going to be like. And it's interesting that in 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, John said, Brethren, it does not has not yet appeared what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And he says, before he says that, he says, we are the sons of God. and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But the creation from the beginning has eagerly been waiting to see what that shall be is going to be. They've been eagerly looking for, the creation has been eagerly looking for, what is God going to turn this humanity that trusts Him into? And He used the word sons, I think, in connection with His earlier statement that those that are led by the Spirit of the sons. He's actually saying, what will faithfulness bring? And the answer is, well, we don't know. It's just going to be enormous and glorious. And the creation knows the enormity of the glory and is eagerly waiting to see what it means. And even if we can't tell what it means, even if we don't know exactly what it means, we do know that it's going to be something highly significant. And interestingly, 2 verses later, he actually tells us what it means. But still in general terms. Because in verse 21, it says, the creation will be set free from its bondage to corruption. And the glory of the children of God is that they're going to be set free. From what? The corruption. All we've ever known, ever since we came into this world, has been the creation corrupted. And the magnitude of the corruption is enormous. And we've gotten to thinking that this is the way it is. This is the way life is. And Paul is saying, you haven't got a clue. That is not the way life is. That's being under the bondage to corruption. And there is a freedom from that that has been promised that you're not going to be able to recognize when you see it. It's going to be a mind-blowing thing, as a friend of mine once always said. Once, always. But anyway, once said and then always repeated it. The idea here is, in this one verse, Paul is exploding this notion that the future anticipation needs to be a major part of our thought. And the implication of that in the context of Romans 8 is that in order to be empowered by the Spirit, we have to have adopted this scenario that is of the Spirit. In other words, when we're living today, we have to adopt the reality that the Spirit has revealed, that the coming glory is beyond comparison to anything we have to put up with, so put up with it. Endure it faithfully, with perseverance, wait.